Hi, everybody. My name is Joe Wall. I'm very definitely an alcoholic. And I don't really know what I'm doing here tonight. I think Jim wanted to hear Betty talk and invited me out of courtesy. Or he figured Ben's only lived about 50 miles away, it'd be inexpensive to bring me here. But I got him on that. I drove to Nashville. So he's got mileage to Nashville and back. I got a round trip ticket on American and flew to Chattanooga. And I got a rental car from Chattanooga, so it ain't gonna be cheap, big boy. But after all, if you're invited to speak, you must have a little stature, and hell, I couldn't just get in the car and drive 50 miles down there. I still got some ego. I have no idea what I'm going to say. I'm not a speaker. Back a few years, when we first came in the program, Betty and I used to go all over the country, so we used to go to New Orleans, all over speaking. That's before I had to get a little honest, and you'll hear about some of that. And it's tougher to talk when it's the second time I've talked in 20-something years. So I don't know what I'm going to say, and I might even cry a little. I told Tom Roof last night, he said he'd been crying quite a bit lately, and I told him, that's fine, Tom. The more you cry, the less you peace. Don't worry about it. So, it's got its pluses, you know. There have been a lot of tears along the way, I guess. Maybe not so much for me, but the ones around me that I hurt. But that's getting a little better. About 56 years ago, I was born. I guess that was bad. And I had 12 years of sobriety before I ever took that first drink. And at the ripe old age of 12, at a fraternity dance one night, someone carried me out in the park. See, I'm no farm boy, and my dad died the day I was 7 years old. And I worshiped my dad. And I wanted to live on the farm and be a good old country boy, just like I was raised. My mother, after my dad died, she thought we should go to city schools and all this. And so she got us into city schools, and I hated it. I got kicked out of school in high school 13 times my freshman year. My sophomore year, I had a fight with two teachers physically. And I'd been kicked out of every class except biology and economics. I mean, biology and phys ed. And phys ed, we only had every other day. So one day I'd go to school an hour and every other day 2 hours. And then I was going to night school to make up and to try to graduate on time. But once I discovered the alcohol at 12, it did something for me. I had the worst inferiority complex that anybody ever had. I literally, if I went to a football game, I could not walk down in front of that crowd and find a seat. My legs would shake so bad I couldn't do it. I'd stand in the end zone and watch the game. But you put a pint in me and a pint on me, if I didn't have a seat on the 50, by God, I'd sit there anyway. It didn't matter. And after the game, if it was 90,000 people there, 89,000 of them knew Joe had been there. I made certain of that. I had ruptured appendix when I was a freshman in high school, and I couldn't play football, and I didn't get to play until I was a junior. And from that first night I drank, though, it relieved all of that. I'd found my comforter in life. It made me feel at ease. I was a good dancer, and I couldn't dance. I was just everything I wanted to be. That night after we went out in the parking lot and drank those beers, I went back into that dance. And I can promise you, I was the highlight of the whole evening. The star of the dance. But it gave me such a good feeling and made me so comfortable that from that day forward, I was never without it. I can remember when we were playing football, we'd get out of school at 2 o'clock. And we had to be back to the dressing room, I don't know, 5:30. I don't remember what time, but there were about three of us. We'd go hit the beer joint, and we'd stay in the beer joint until we had to go back and dress out. And everybody used to talk about that Wall kid, what a defensive player he was, that I believe he'd hit a freight train head on. What they didn't know was I drunk. Hell, I probably would have. You know, I'd hit anything. It didn't make much difference. And I even got to where there was a big oak tree at this school, and it had a big hole in the side of it. And at night, I'd go over there and slip me a couple of six-packs in that hole and slip out during the day and get behind that oak tree and drink that beer. I had another kid that I had the first class of the morning with, and his dad was a bootlegger. And he'd bring a pint of vodka and two Donald Duck straws, and we'd sit in that class and drink that pint of vodka through those straws. And the rest of the day, we were pretty well primed, you can imagine. So I was never, that I can remember from that day forward, without alcohol. I can remember my graduation night, I wasn't allowed to walk down the aisle. They said I was too drunk. And I think they mailed me my diploma about 90 days later. But this is the way I was an instant alcoholic. Some people say we're born that way. Some people say we drink ourselves into it. I don't know. By the way, John said if he did this, it meant he was running out of tape. So I'm going to try to make this brief. But I drank like that all through high school. I got into college. I started playing football in college, and then I discovered aviation. At Middle Tennessee State in Murfreesboro, you can earn credits for aviation classes. So I got into aviation, and I kept going with it, and I went straight on and got my commercial pilot's ticket. And I started fooling. I was real young at the time, and before I got my commercial, I looked over my age, and I remember I took one of my flight instructors to Mississippi to get a job crop dusting. I didn't even have a commercial ticket at the time, and he took his check ride, and the guy looked over at me, says, "You fly?" I said, "Yeah." He didn't ask me about a license, and he says, "You want to take a check ride?" I said, "Yeah." So I took a check ride and passed it, and I stayed down there that summer and flew Stearman's dusting before I ever had a commercial license. I was always step ahead. When I was a junior in high school, I was dating a senior in college. He was my practice teacher in typing. I didn't run with the kids my age. You know, post office and spin the bottle just wasn't for me. I wanted to be better games out there I've heard about you could play. So I was always looking for something better. Always wanting to live on the edge. Always wanting to do something outdo everybody else, I think. But anyway, during the time I was flying, later on, I got a job flying during Governor Folsom's second term in Alabama during the Folsom administration. And I was assigned to the military department. I was a private in the National Guard and a lieutenant in the state militia so I could fly guard planes. I was co-pilot on Puddle Jumper number 2, the one that went to the Orange Bowl that some of you people from Alabama remember. Y'all raised so much hell about Folsom taking all of his friends to the Orange Bowl on a state plane. I was co-pilot on that plane. We didn't do a lot of flying. We did a lot of drinking. Jim had a little affinity to take a drink once in a while. In fact, it was about daily. So we had a big time. During the time I was flying for him, I'd borrowed one of the state planes and come back to Murfreesboro for a football game one weekend. And after the game, I was walking into a restaurant and had my hand on the doorknob, and a guy came up behind me and hit me right here with a full bottle of beer. I broke it over my head. It cold cocked me, and he stuck the broken end in both eyes. I lost his eye. Through surgery, some nurses kind of screwed up, but we won't go into that. But anyway, I quit flying because of my depth perception for a while, and I got into sales. And I love sales. And I got into the scrap iron business, or Milton calls it car sales. I call it scrap iron business. And I was out in Wichita, Kansas. I'd taken a geographical tour, so I went to Wichita. And I worked for a bootleg car dealer out there. We had about 300 new cars. We had our own service department. We had our own warranty. You'd come in and buy anything from a new Chevrolet up to a Lincoln Cadillac, anything you wanted. We started at 8 in the morning, and the lot closed at midnight, 7 days a week. And there were quite a few of those boys that drank. And we drank on the job. And I usually, at first, I didn't start drinking until late afternoon, but I would drink until 4 or 5 the next morning, because I'd work to midnight, and I'd go close all the joints in South Wichita. Sleep a couple of hours and right back, but I was young and I could take it. And then finally it got to be 1 o'clock, and finally I'd start at noon, and finally I was bringing my booze to work with me. And I'd work all day long, and I worked 7 days. And this was in the late 50s, and I had a lot of weeks. I earned $2,500, $3,000. We got paid on Friday. I'd have to go in on Thursday night and get a draw to get my dry cleaning out and eat dinner. But I was having a good time. There wasn't a woman in South Wichita didn't know Big Joe. I had a light orchid-colored 56 Lincoln convertible. The old country boy had arrived. So I was right in my niche. One night I was in one of these joints in Wichita, and I just fell out. I passed out. They rushed me to the hospital. They put me in a room with another guy, and I look over at him, and I said, "What are you in here for?" He said, "I had a heart attack." And they thought I'd had a heart attack. And after the doctor examined me, he said, "Boy, I have never seen a man your age, you're as young as you are, as dissipated as you are." He says, "What in the hell are you doing?" He said, "You are absolutely worn out." I didn't sleep. I'd sleep a couple hours a night. And just, all I did was drink and work. I left Wichita. I came back to Nashville, and I became sales manager I was the youngest sales manager this Ford dealership had ever had. I alienated every salesman he had. Some of them had been there for several years. I walked in, 3 months later, I was promoted to salesman. You see, I was a born salesman. I used to say making a sale to me was better than having orgasm. As I get older, I'm wondering about that. Because, you know, as you get older, you don't know whether it's going to be your last one or not. So, I still love to sell, don't get me wrong. I brought this guy's sales up to a point they'd never been before. One night, a friend of mine and I, we were riding around, and it started sleeting and snowing. And I remember I was drinking Old Crow and chasing it with Falstaff. And I remember him saying something about how warm and pretty and sunny it was in Miami. And I remember me agreeing with him and us talking about it, but I blacked out right along in there somewhere till I woke up sometime next morning. I looked out the window, he had all these pine trees going by, and I looked over and Dan's driving. I said, "Oh my God, we're on our way to Miami." I got down to Miami and I continued on in the scrap iron business till I met a lady from Canada who ran a modeling, had run a modeling school. Her husband had got killed in a jet crash and she'd gotten a lot of insurance money. And she didn't work, and she didn't like it because I worked, so I quit work, and I became a something. I don't know what you call it, but it was worse than being married, I'll tell you that. So that lasted till, see, I was told because I lost my eye, I'd never have to go into service. And one morning, somebody knocked on the door, and it was a master sergeant. And he said, "Mr. Wall, we've been trying to find you because you need to get examined for the Army." I said, "I don't have to go to the Army." I said, "I'm blind in one eye." He said, "That's not my instructions." He said, "You got to go back to Nashville and be examined." So I went back to Nashville and got examined and got out blind in my left eye, and my right eye was my shooting eye. They said, "I was all right." So I joined the Navy and reported to go to the Navy, and we were supposed to have been down there at 4:30 one morning to catch a plane. I got there on time, and then they said the plane wasn't going to leave till 4 that afternoon. And I said, "Well, we don't have to sit here, do we? Can't we go downtown?" They said, "Yes." So I went downtown to all my old haunts. The time I got back at 4:30, I was barely able to walk. And this little lieutenant or whatever he was, he looked at me, he said, "Mr. Wall, you're not going to the Navy today, tomorrow, the next day, or never." And I said, "Well, could I have my records and my test scores?" And he said, "Yeah." I staggered next door to the Air Force. I said, "Y'all need a good man?" I said, "Yeah, come on in." Next morning, I was on my way to Lackland Air Force Base. Now, I became a lab tech. And if y'all don't know it, in the laboratory, that's where we would do a lot of work with 200 proof alcohol, fixing cancer tissue to slides. And my favorite job was every now and then one of us was assigned to do the alcohol count at the end of the day. We kept it under lock and key. But you ever have one of those field jackets that had the drawstring in it, you know, and you could pull it real tight around the middle? I'd always do the count with my field jacket on because it was the end of the day and I was going home anyway, and those pints of alcohol would just jump in there. And we'd go back to the barracks and mix that stuff with grapefruit juice, and it tasted exactly like vodka. But I had... Now, at this time, I was 20-something years old. 23, I guess. I can't remember dates. See, my memory, I had a doctor that was a real good friend of mine, and he absolutely meant no harm, and he knew I was an alcoholic, and but they had a miracle drug come out one time. See, I never slept past 3 o'clock in the morning. And he put me on this new miracle glove drug. It was absolutely non-habit forming. There's a brand new thing that just come out called Xanax. And then he put me on Halcyon at night. And I stayed on that 4 years. It destroyed my memory. I was down at New Life Lodge one day and I saw this boy laying in a fetal position in the corner. I said, what the hell's wrong with him? They said, he's coming off of Xanax. I said, oh my God. I called my sponsor. I said, Clarence. My sponsor's Clarence S. from Nashville, and some of you know him. Clarence is real slow. It takes Clarence an hour and a half to watch 60 Minutes. He's so slow. Clarence said, well, Joe, you're in trouble. He says, the only way you come off of that stuff is go to treatment. I says, hell, I ain't going to treatment. He goes and talks to this addictologist, and this addictologist come up with this big deal, the way I could taper off. But see, I never did take the full dosage because I couldn't operate on the full dosage. And so I went by Clarence's schedule for a week, I think, and finally one night I threw him down the commode and I went home. And that was the end of Halcyon and Xanax for me, but it just obliterated my memory. So dates absolutely escaped me. Now I don't know where I was. I guess I was still in the Air Force, wasn't I? Did I get out? So I was 20-something, and I'd have these 18-year-olds, they'd just be strung out all over the barracks. I mean, passed out off this 200-proof alcohol, and I'd still be navigating. I had a chance to go to Wiesbaden, Germany, and I had a senior master sergeant, and this guy, he and I, his name was John Smith, and that was his real name. And he begged me, he said, Joe, he said, don't go over there. He says, you ain't gonna like it. He says, sending a senior master sergeant over there from up northern Texas and says, he ain't gonna like you and you ain't gonna like him and y'all ain't gonna get along. He says, stay here at Lackland with me. I had a choice of going or not going because I'd finished topping my training because John saw to that. I'd go over to his bachelor's non-commissioned officer quarters every night and drink with him. So I got top grades. And I was probably the loudest one in the whole lab. But I asked some other people about Wiesbaden. They said, it's great. So I decided to go. And he was right. 30 minutes after I got there, me and this senior master sergeant, we locked up. And I stayed there about a year. And one morning, we physically went at it. And I put him in the hospital. And they put me in Ward 6B. Now, 6B is a nut ward for some of you who don't know what it is. And I stayed in there tooling leather and copper and weaving baskets. And I was trying to tell them I wasn't crazy, that I was just being drunk. And they'd take your razors away from you and all that, and had a guy stand there and watch you shave. And I used to look at him every morning, I'd say, hey, you son of a bitch, if you think I'm going to cut my throat, you crazy. I want out of here to get some more cognac, you know. I ain't going to kill myself yet because I ain't through. Finally, I met with a colonel one morning, and he asked me if I'd take a 3916. I didn't know what he was talking about, but I found out it was unadaptable to the military service. I said, Colonel, whip it on me. It was honorable. And so it's going to take me about 2 weeks to process out. And during that time, we had the Mia Earhart Hotel next door. We lived on the hospital ground, and we had this big hotel next door where 700 single women lived. They were civil service workers, American school teachers over there, a lot of Swedish nurses, and that was my favorite hangout. They used to have a deal at night when the bar closed, they'd throw the key in the middle of the floor and you'd run and grab a key and that was your date. I always wound up with this old 55-year-old Red Cross gal, but she had money and scotch and steaks, you know, and I was drunk. So during that 2 weeks, I'd have to report to the first sergeant every morning, and I'd tell him where I was going. I said, "Sergeant, I'm going to Mia for a little while." And finally, after a couple of days, he said, "Wall," he said, "if you're going over there, please, please come back before 5 or after 5. He says, "You come back down this hospital sidewalk at 5 o'clock, drunk on the Lord. These other guys been working all day, and you're over here on a European holiday while you're waiting around to go home." And he said, "It just don't look good." Anyway, I get back home, and I better shorten this thing up. And I didn't mean to get in this much of a drunkalogue. But I started selling I got back in the scrap iron business. And I had an affair with the owner's wife, and that wound that up. Then I started selling door-to-door insurance, hospitalization. Several of us used to get together, and one of the old boys I used to do, he's in the program, Sam F. Rose, you might know him in Nashville. Sam and I worked for this company together, and we'd go into a little community, 7 or 8 of us, and we'd just canvass it. And we had a dental policy. And one day we'd stopped at noon to have our usual 7-8 beers. And I told Sam, I said, "Sam, how many did you get this morning?" He was telling me, and I said, "Well," I said, "I'll beat you this day." And I said, "I'll tell you what else I'm going to do. I'm going to sell somebody with false teeth a dental policy. I bet you 50 bucks." So he bet me 50 I couldn't, and I found this old woman with false teeth, and I was telling her about pyrrhea of the gums and that this disease could attack her even though she had false teeth. I scared her to death. She bought the dental policy. After I collected my 50 from Sam, I did go back and get a lady her money back, but I could sell anything. And I had a secretary. I'd been made, wasn't long, I was put in charge of office. I always excelled at sales, and I used to go in this little coffee shop each morning. I saw this gal sitting in there and a cup of coffee. I went back to my office, I asked my secretary, I said, "I saw a girl in this coffee shop," and I described her. She said, "Oh, I know who that is." So "That's Betty Jenkins." And I said, "Well, get me a date with her." She said, "Okay." She said, "When do you want one?" I said, "I don't know, anytime." So that afternoon or the next morning sometime, she said, "My husband and I are going to the horse show in Nashville, and you got a date with Betty." She says, "You want to go?" I said, "Sure." I had a bright red Oldsmobile. And of course, I didn't go anywhere without my whiskey. And I don't remember much about the horse show, except I dropped my bottle of wine. I had it laying down and got to rolling down the bleachers. And I was lunging through all those people trying to catch that bottle. So Betty thought it was time we left the horse show, and we was walking around out in the parking lot hunting my car, and she said, "Here's your car, Joe." And I said, "No, it ain't my car." And it was, but we kept looking because I insisted it wasn't my car. And finally, when everybody else in the parking lot had left and it wasn't nothing but one bright red Oldsmobile there, I believed it was my car. Now, this should have given her some clue as to what my problem was. The next day, we went to Center Hill Lake. I passed out and rolled home with my head in her lap, my feet out the window of her car. But she had 3 little boys, and one of them had a broken collarbone, one of the twins, and she was so worn out working and taking care of these kids. I sat up all one night and held this kid because he couldn't sleep because I was drinking, and it suited me. I just stayed up all night drinking and held him. She thought I was wonderful. She even went to the safari that a month or so later, she kidnapped me and took me to a neighboring county and married me. Now, I had $20 in my pocket, a 6-pack of Falstaff, and I gave the JP $10 to marry us and $10 tip to hurry up so my beer wouldn't get hot. Stopped on the way home at the Breeze Inn, John knows where the Breeze Inn is. and charged a case of beer. They had charge counts all over the county. And about 90 days, I sobered up and realized I was married. And that was awful. And it was kind of up and down, up and down. You know, I lost more clothes dragging them from my house to the car than I'd go home. And on one of these drunks, my brother convinced me I needed help, my younger brother, and he talked me into going into the VA hospital. Now, the doctor that was out there, I'd been in Cub Scouts with his sons and Boy Scouts, and at the time, they didn't have an alcohol program, and he made sure I knew this, and he told me that, though being as he was a friend of the family, he's going to let me in and try to help me anyway, I'd be put in there with someone had problems just like me. I wouldn't be put in with the crazies and everything. So they put me in there, but they locked the door behind me. And I hadn't been in there very long, and I hadn't had a drink in about 3 days, but I was coming unglued. And I went to the bathroom, and here was a guy in there tracing the tiles, the grout in the tiles, doing this. I didn't think much of it. I thought he'd bored. I came back in there about an hour later, and he's still there doing it. I said, whoop, we got a problem. I was talking to another old boy in the hallway. I said, how long have you been in here? He said, 6 years and 38 shock treatments. And I said, oh, my God. I was really getting shaky. There's an old boy sitting there in the day room watching TV, and about every 10 minutes, he'd jump straight up in the air and scream. I said, oh, my God. That night, I couldn't sleep, and the nurse said, well, I'll help you. She gave me something like a horse pill, and she come back about 30 minutes, an hour later, and I was still playing solitaire. She said, you mean you're not knocked out yet? And I said, no. She said, here, take this. This will put you out. She come back about 30 minutes, an hour later, I was still playing solitaire. So then she went and called the doctor, and this time she come back with a shot. She gave me a shot, come back about an hour later, and I'm still sitting there playing. She couldn't knock me out. I was wired. Next morning, we go down to the chow hall, and I'm doing pretty good. I'm bringing a fork full of eggs up my mouth, and my eyes locked on a guy over at a table. He had two fried eggs in his hand, stuffing them in his mouth, and the yellow one. And I started looking for a way out of there. I got up and started down the hall, and this orderly was taking his key and unlocking the outside door. I imagine that's the last thing he remembered for a little while, because I hit him wide open. I mean, he never... And I escaped. That night, I made my first AA meeting. And I felt like I'd had the world lifted off my shoulders. These people were going to help me. For about 90 days, I was riding a pink cloud. I could drive by those beer joints and not stop and get a beer and just doing great. I had about 6 months sobriety, and I went to Dallas, Texas, and I was so proud of myself. The stewardess come around ordering drinks, and I wouldn't buy one. No, ma'am, thank you. Soon my feet hit the ground in Dallas. I got in a cab, stopped at the first liquor store. Betty had to come get me out of a hotel about a week later because the manager called her begging for somebody to come get this SOB because we don't know what to do with it. They brought me back to Nashville, had it set up to put me in Central State. They threw my whiskey away the night they got there, though. That was the bad part. On the flight back to Nashville, no drinking or nothing. When they got me to Central State, they refused to take me because I was too sober. So I ruined their plans there. Everybody tried to sober me up. But those first few days, I understand there's a lot of newcomers here. I did nothing right in this program, those first few months. I couldn't listen. I couldn't get one day at a time. I was only 30 years old, and I was going to live to be 170 years when them old dim lights, jukeboxes, and miniskirts were just too long. I could not get one day at a time. I didn't get a sponsor. I had a big book. I never read it. I couldn't ask God for anything. See, I suffered from what's known as the John Wayne syndrome. I got myself into this mess. By God, I'll shoot my way out. You know, I was going to do it all by myself. 6'4", weighed 250 pounds, and if anybody thought they was going to catch me with my knees bent, they were crazy. I couldn't ask for help. I played around with this program for years, and finally, when the pain got so great, one morning my knees did bend, and I cried out for help. And I started getting a little bit honest. I had a spiritual closeness with God that I can't describe. During that time, I got out of the shower one morning. I was towel drying my left leg, and I couldn't feel my leg, and I knew something was wrong. And I went to the doctor, and they ran me through a battery of tests, and finally we decided to I was going to have to do surgery. Same surgery Rose Morris had, and it left Morris when he first had his paralyzed from here down in the beginning. And later on, he got to where he could walk with a walker and leg braces, and it was a pretty serious operation. I had a 50-50 chance of living through it, I think, is what Betty told me, and I had a 20% chance of walking afterwards. I never gave it a second thought. I didn't think any more about that than I would have going to get my teeth cleaned. And my doctor was amazed. But that's the spiritual closeness I had with God at that point in my life. I came out of that surgery. One of my pigeons was there and another friend of mine when I woke up and I told him, I said, I can't use this urinal. I've got to go to the bathroom. I got up and put one hand on one of them's shoulder and one on the other and walked to the bathroom. The nurse walked in and caught me. And she went out and told everybody I was walking. And my doctor came running down the hall of St. Thomas Hospital, screaming, he walks, and jumping about 4 foot in the air and landing about every 10 yards. I stayed at home for about a year. I spent most of a year. We lived in a condo at the time, and we had a big bedroom, about a 30 by 30 bedroom, and I lived in that bedroom. And I sat in a recliner most of the time. I wasn't allowed to drive a car, and Betty used to drive me. At the time, I was working for a company, a financial planning company. We did a lot of real estate syndications. We handled stocks, bonds, insurance, the whole gamut of investments. And I'd been fairly successful. But after about a year off from work, I had pretty well depleted what money I had. And I went back and I spent another year cleaning up and getting my clients all caught up because they hadn't been serviced properly. And then at the end of that year, I told Betty, I said, I'm going into business for myself. I can't stay there any longer. Now, a couple of guys had just left and they told me, they said, Joe, don't leave unless you got about $60,000 to start a business on. I went to the bank, borrowed $5,000, and with that $5,000 and sheer guts, I went into business. When I got my office set up and laid aside enough money for my secretary's first week's pay, I had $98. That was in 1981. I worked night and day. Every client I had at the old company stayed with me. I had clients that bought things from me that they didn't bit more need than a man in the moon. They only did it to help me. Tommy, the son that came up here and met me this morning to play golf with me, he would drive me on weekends while I slept. I was working. I was going to build this thing. It became successful beyond my wildest imagination. See, I was out there making my mark in the world. But during that time, I got away from AA. I got away from God. The chase for money and power became my God. One night in Chicago, I had to make several trips a year to Chicago, Orlando, all over. I was on a national board of a large company, and we were in Chicago one night for a meeting. We were in the Western Hotel up there off of Michigan Avenue. And they were having a little cocktail party before dinner. And this guy told me, he said, Joe, don't you want a drink? I said, no, I don't care for one. I said, I'm allergic to alcohol. He said, well, how about a wine spritzer? He says, wine spritzers won't bother you. I said, what's a spritzer? I didn't know what it was. He said, oh, just a little wine, a little soda. He said, try one. So, you know, a man as successful as I am at this point and with my stature, you know, maybe I might not be an alcoholic. I forgot about the VA hospital and the Ward 6B, you know. I'd come a long way since then, so I drank that wine spritzer. And I found out I could drink 3 or 4 wine spritzers, eat dinner, and go on about my business, and it was fine. I even took Betty to Florida one time. And before dinner, I'd have wine spritzers, eat dinner, and then that's it. And she got to wondering whether or not I was an alcoholic. I conned her. But you know the rest of the story. It wasn't long before when I went to Chicago, Bill's Limousine Service, I'd call him before I left Nashville. I'd tell Bill what time I was arriving at O'Hare. And I'd have his limousine pick me up. And we'd stop by this big supermarket liquor store, like a Kroger. And they had guys on each end of the aisle giving out samples of rum, scotch, vodka. You'd get drunk just shopping. And if I was only going to be there 2 nights, I'd get 3 gallons of wine and all this soda, and they'd pack it in a big box and tape it up. These big hotels frown on you bringing in your own booze. And I left so many gallons of wine in Chicago, Texas, Fort Lauderdale, Orlando. And it just got progressively worse. I'd been in Fort Lauderdale, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 days, a week. And this guy who had become my closest friend in Dallas, Texas, he was having a birthday in Dallas after we were leaving Fort Lauderdale. And somebody told me, said, Joe, said, we need to fly to Dallas and help Dave celebrate his birthday. So that sounded like a good idea to me, and I was full of them spritzers, so I just get on a plane and go to Dallas. Betty's at home, going crazy, wondering what in the hell's going on. I'm flying all over the country. I get in Dallas, and I really got in a hell of a shape in Dallas. Evidently, I don't know. I know I flew only first class because a man of my stature, you know, we couldn't fly back there with the chickens and the common folk. And I'd gotten on the plane in Dallas, and I was buckled in, and a guy came up, and he said, Mr. Wall, would you come go with me? And he took me off of that airplane, and he sent me out there, and he said, I think it'd be better if you caught the next flight to Nashville. Evidently, I passed out, went to sleep, and I don't know what woke me up, but I woke up just before the other flight was leaving, and I was fumbling around in my pockets looking for a cigarette, and I felt something in my pocket, and I pulled it out, and it was a little religious tract that somebody, while I was passed out, had stuck in my pocket, and written across the front of it in ballpoint pen was, God still loves you. And I knew right then what I had to do. This was in 1986. Betty had been disappearing from my home for a while anyway, and I didn't know where she was going. But I did notice, and I should have known, because she got to where she didn't say nothing about my drinking. Didn't really seem to care where I went when I came home or how much I drank. That should have given me a clue that she was back in Al-Anon. I came back into AA. Now, this good friend of mine in Dallas, the guy that I'd bankwired, he was so close to me, I bankwired him $170,000 one time to bail him out of trouble. I had no note, no nothing. That's how well I trusted this guy. He got me into a potash mining deal out in New Mexico. And I'd bought a bunch of potash mining equipment and leased it back to this company. And the lease payments were coming in, and I'd call Dave. I'd say, Dave, how's everything going? And he said, Joe, it's business as usual. And I'd been out to Carlsbad a couple of times and checked on it, and everything looked good. Finally, one morning, they'd bought this company. It was Potash Corporation of America, and they'd bought it from Ideal Basics, a big blue chip cement company out of Denver, Colorado. And I called the comptroller at Ideal Basics one morning because something was wrong, and I could feel it. And I asked him, I said, how's everything going at the mine? He said, Joe, you hadn't heard? And I said, no, what? He said, you hadn't seen the El Paso, the Dallas, the Albuquerque papers? I said, no, we don't. I don't normally get them every morning here in Nashville. He says, you're in all of them. I said, oh. He says, yeah. He says, I'm going to Jacksonville, Florida in a few days. He says, I'll be flying back through Nashville. On Sunday, he said, would you like me to stop and talk with you? And I said, I sure would. And I had my lawyer there. We picked him up at the airport, and we went to my office, and he opened up a briefcase full of newspaper clippings. When they bought this potash mining company, there was a $22 million pension plan that came with it. I had borrowed $2 million from that plan as a partial down payment on this equipment I'd purchased. We were in the process of immunizing this plan. Now, what that is, if a plan's overfunded, you can pull out the excess funding and put it back into the company. But they couldn't wait for the year or so for this to take place, so they just started taking money indiscriminately. And they took the whole $22 million. They didn't even leave anything to fund the liability with. And the government was coming down on them pretty heavy, and my name was in all of these papers as being the big financier in Nashville who was behind all this. And I knew nothing of it. The next morning, my lawyer and I, we were on a plane to Albuquerque to meet with the United States attorney. And I got out there and they had indictments about this thick, and I was one of them. I was fixing to be federally indicted for stealing $22 million from a pension plan that I had no idea had taken place. And we sat down and talked to him, and he said, Joe, we know that you didn't steal the money. We know what your part was. He said, but we're going to indict you so you'd roll over and be a witness. I became a witness. I wasn't criminally indicted, but the Labor Department sued me for $30 million because the Labor Department didn't like people tampering with their pension plans, and they said that I was a fiduciary, even though I wasn't. But believe me, the government can, if they want you, they'll do anything. We had continued to be successful, and Betty and I, we never The only luxury we had was a couple of luxury automobiles and a boat. We had a pretty nice motor yacht, and we didn't belong to country clubs. Big night out for us was Shoney's. And we'd saved a lot of money. And I paid those attorneys $700,000 to try to get out of this civil suit and keep all of my stuff. See, I had 8 corporations. I had 140 pieces of rental property, trailer parks, Honda dealership, building supply business, industrial supply business, financial planning businesses. And I wanted to keep my stuff. And I used to get up and call Clarence at 6:30 every morning. I said, Clarence, I'd be hyperventilating some morning. And Clarence said, well, Jerry, all you gotta do is clean up and show up and everything will work out. God, I wanted to kill him. Clean up, and so I'd clean up, and I'd show up. And it was back and forth and back and forth to New Mexico. And finally one day I asked the lawyer, I said, what's it going to finally, ultimately cost? He said, Joe, it could run another $1 million in attorney's fees. And I said, not for me. He says, what do you mean not for you? He says, you don't have a choice. I said, yes, I do. He said, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to belly up. He says, you can't. You got too much net worth. Betty and I talked about it. And things never meant that much to Betty. See, the only way I ever showed my love during a lot of those years was to show my love of if I got in deep Kim shit, it was another tennis bracelet, another solitary diamond, a new Mercedes convertible. See, and that wasn't what they wanted. All they ever wanted was me, to pat them on the back and say, I love you. For Daddy to be there when they needed him. But see, I thought this was it. So when I finally made up my mind, and everybody, I met with the bank one morning, and there was, they had me in one of those mahogany tables about as long as this room. And they was sitting there telling me what I could do and what I couldn't do. And this guy said, well, you can't bankrupt, says your net worth is too much. I had a big old ring of keys in my pocket that fit a lot of doors, and I just pulled it out and I slid it down that big mahogany table. I said, hey, if you think it's such a ball, you go try running it. I'm tired. I'm gone. We lost everything we had. We didn't have anything. A few years before, I had a younger brother, and he'd gotten into real estate, and I had helped him along, and we'd done a couple of deals, and I made him some pretty big money that he didn't have to turn a hand for, and it got him started, and he was real successful. And he had been telling me while I was down there, hyperventilating every morning, he said, Joe, if you'll just roll over, he says, you got nothing to worry about. He said, I'll have you a place to live. You'll have an automobile. But see, it was that false pride. It was that ego. I couldn't let it go. I couldn't let it go. Fear. You know, all emotions, I believe, come from either fear or love. And fear was my big stumbling block. Those years when I was trying to make it in the program, you know, and I was sitting there holding that winning hand, and AA raised me, and I wouldn't call that raise because I didn't want to hurt, or I didn't want to walk through that wall of fear. I folded a winning hand, and I was constantly getting a new hand. That's why it took me so long to get this simple program. Some of the side benefits I've gotten out of it, though, I was at home that night and I was sober. My daughter, John, remembers when we used to take her to meetings in a stroller. She came in one Saturday night, 17 years old, threw her arms around my neck, said, "Daddy, I've got to have help." We had no idea. Straight A student. She'd gotten hooked on Robitussin and then gone to vodka. I called my sponsor about 2 o'clock in the morning. We had her in Charter Lakeside in Memphis. 7 weeks of pure hell that kid went through. I guess they do a good job, but it was heartbreaking to see what she had to put up with. It was worse than a prison down there. I'd cry all the way home every Monday night after we left her. She just celebrated her 3rd birthday in AA. She's carrying a 3.88 at UT, finishing her sophomore year, going to Bonn, Germany next year to school. She never leaves home without saying, "Dad, I love you," and giving me a big kiss. No matter who's around. Tommy, the son that came down to play golf with me this morning, went 7 years without hardly speaking to me. He's in the program now. He's found out what resentment was. For the last 6 months, he's been coming back around. We have another son out in Seattle, Washington. He's not in AA, he chose NA. He's got 8 or 9 years now, I don't know how. I can't keep up, told you dates, I couldn't remember. So see, I stand here tonight blessed. And I don't have the successful story to tell you about that a lot of people do. That from the first day they came into AA, they never took a drink. But I now believe, you know, I used to think when I first came in this program that anybody went to a treatment center was a panty waste. There ain't no right or wrong way to get it. It took this for me. It took every bit of it for me. I used to pray for humility. I didn't want such a big load of it, but that's the way I got it. People used to come up to me and say, "Joe, I don't see how you walk around smiling. I believe I'd have blown my brains out." But see, once I made up my mind that peace of mind and happiness was worth more than all the stuff in the world, and it wasn't hard. And I have no regrets. Probably 1% of the people will never have gotten to where I'd gotten to and enjoyed some of the things I had. But all those things that we enjoyed, the traveling and the things that Betty and I did and the automobiles, the motor yachts, everything we had, don't even come close to what we have today. Don't even come close to touching it. You know, it gets pretty boring around the house sometimes. We don't fight anymore. We just don't fight. She's got her program, I got mine. If I want to have a pity party, that's fine, but I'm going to do it by myself. And vice versa. That good friend of mine in Dallas, Texas, you know, oftentimes I want to call him and say, "Thank you, Dave. You did me the biggest favor anybody could have ever done me." And he was the best friend I had in the world, I thought. Till I found out the best friend, the best buddy I ever had in this world, y'all are going to hear speak in the morning. I want to thank you for your time, and I'm just grateful to be here and be breathing in and out. Thank you.